The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, this is a lecture. Not even going to pretend otherwise. It has a title. It's called The Disappearance of the Righteous, Psalms 14, 53, and Romans 3. A lot of stuff I'm going to cover. It's longer than I should normally give, I'm going to put my head down, tail up, and see where we go. In last Friday's chapel, Al Groves spoke eloquently of the life and legacy of Raymond Dillard, late Professor of Old Testament Language and Literature here at Westminster. Ray died 10 years ago on October the 1st, 1993, and Al's message was a fitting tribute that anticipated that sad anniversary. In a somewhat different way, I want to also pay tribute to Ray. It's a more indirect way, and I want to explore his hermeneutical legacy. Now, what then is the hermeneutical legacy of Ray Dillard? Strictly speaking, Ray's work on Chronicles was an exercise in redaction criticism, how Chronicles modified the story of Israel that was told previously in the Book of Kings. But there's more to Ray's work than that. What he introduced us to was the phenomenon of inner biblical exegesis, the Bible's interpretation of itself. His work was limited to the Old Testament, but I do see a strong link between that interest and the more recent focus with some of my colleagues in New Testament use of the Old Testament. Both areas of study seek to answer the question, what's going on when the biblical writers interpret earlier canonical texts? So that's what Ray was very interested in, and I see this trajectory that he established there in the 70s and into the 80s being continued by the work of people like Dan McCartney, Pete Enns, and so forth, into the late 80s, 90s, and zeros of where we are now at Westminster. Ray was never afraid to ask questions, that question I just posed, what's going on in a biblical interpretation, never afraid to ask that question, even when his answers got him into trouble, and they often did. As Al put it last week, Ray used to bring texts together that normally didn't get brought together, texts that sit in the same canon, sit there a bit uneasily, perhaps, to quote Al's words. Some of the answers to the problem of the relationship of Kings and Chronicles that Ray came up with made people uneasy. Ray, for example, taught that that Chronicles' creative retelling of Israel's history, he would not publicly use the word midrash to describe what was going on in Chronicles, but privately he would. But he said that creative retelling that was going on in Chronicles was as much influenced by the chronicler's moment in redemptive history as it was by the facts that he was narrating. I'm going to get that point, is that the story, the shape of the story was took its shape from where the chronicler was in his moment of history. And many people were uncomfortable with that idea. But Ray's work was always as edifying as it was challenging. Al mentioned this last week. Ray brought text together in difficult and challenging ways, but at the end of the day, he always sought to do that in the light of Christ, again quoting Al's words, and I think that's one of the great legacies of Ray Dillard. Today I want to honour the memory of Ray Dillard, my mentor, and all too briefly my colleague here at Westminster. I want to explore the Dillard legacy by considering a small piece of inner biblical exegesis, inner biblical interpretation, not in Chronicles, but in Psalms. As some of you might know, I tend to spend my chapel talks looking at Psalms. And today I want to keep that tradition going, but the anniversary of Ray's death inspires me to do it in a way that seeks to preserve his legacy. So today we'll be looking at two Psalms that are almost identical, Psalms 14 and 53. So you might want to kind of keep your finger in both as we flip between them. I will quickly exegete, as quickly as I can, Psalm 14, and then I'll ask, what are we to make of the few differences between the two Psalms? And then finally, I want to extend the Dillard trajectory. by posing the more recent Westminster question, what are we to make of Paul's quotations of these psalms in Romans 3? Be warned, as I said, this is a lecture, not a sermon. Let's read through Psalm 14 and 53. I'll try and do it together. For the director of music of David, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. Their deeds are vile. There is no one who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven. And at this point, Psalm 53 says that God looks down. This is a feature of Psalm 53. It's from the second book of the Psalter, the so-called Elohistic Psalter, which tends to insert the word Elohim, God, rather than the word Adonai, Yahweh, the Lord. That's just a distinctive feature, no great significance in that. So the Lord looks down from heaven on the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, any who seek God. All have turned aside. Now here Psalm 53 uses a slightly different word. It uses the word sarg from the root sug instead of the word sar. It's turned. Psalm 53 turned back rather than turned aside. Both carry the same basic idea of not staying on the path that the Lord has set before you. So it's just slight variation there that I probably won't make much of. So they've all turned aside or turned back. They have together become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. Will evildoers never learn? Those who devour my people as men eat bread and who do not call on the Lord. Again, Psalm 53, here has God rather than the Lord. But at this point, the two psalms actually diverge. I'll read Psalm 14, actually verses 5 and 6. There they are, actually better, there they were, overwhelmed with dread, for God is present in the company of the righteous. You evildoers frustrate the plans of the poor, but the Lord is their refuge. In place of these two verses, Psalm 53 just reads, there's just one verse and it reads, there they were, overwhelmed with dread. Where there was nothing to dread, God scattered the bones of those who attacked you. You put them to shame, for God despised them. Actually, some difficult stuff there, but you can see there's some interesting changes if that's what's going on. Finally, an odd verse in many ways, surprising. I suspect this actually might be a later canonical insertion. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion when the Lord or God restores the fortunes of his people. Let Jacob rejoice and be glad. Now, Psalm 14, we'll focus there first, is usually said to be talking about atheists, people who deny the very existence of God. But I'm not sure that that's what's in view. Quite frankly, in the world in which the Old Testament is written, I think you would have been hard-pressed to find a single atheist, at least an atheist in the way that we typically use that word. The ancients were incorrigibly religious. They would have regarded Israel's worship of one God to the exclusion of all others as a dangerously minimalistic religion. It's almost bordering on atheism to have only one God for the ancients. And for them, the modern secular move from monotheism to atheism would have been a heresy. Well, that inclines me to read the statement, there is no God, as expressing what I would call a practical atheism rather than a theoretical or philosophical atheism. Reading Psalm 14 in its literary context is another thing I'm interested in, is psalms, individual psalms in the context of their surrounding psalms. I notice that this psalm is preceded by another psalm, that would be Psalm 13, which opens with the words, O Lord, will you forget me forever? Will you hide your face from me? In other words, the previous psalm wrestles with the problem of God's apparent absence, his apparent violation of his covenant promise to be with his people and protect them and save them. Actually, a number of the preceding psalms are dealing with the same problem, the problem of God's absence, and none more pointedly than Psalm 10. Why, O Lord, do you stand afar off? This whole idea of God at a distance. Why do you hide your face in times of trouble? In each of these psalms, it is as though it is that the Lord's problem, the Lord's absence, I should say, is not a theoretical problem. It is a problem that is to be solved. It's to be solved only in the context of oppression by wicked people. So for the writer of Psalm 10, God's absence, God standing at a distance, is a pressing problem precisely because the wicked man hunts down the weak, In other words, it's not just, oh, God's at a distance, but God's at a distance precisely when I need him, when I'm under attack from enemies. Or in Psalm 11, the wicked shoot from the shadow at the upright in heart. In Psalm 11, they oppress the weak, in verse 5. And this raises the problem of God that you find throughout the Psalter. Where is God when you need him most? Apparently, he's absent, or at a distance, or so it seems, because the unrighteous, the wicked, mercilessly oppress the righteous. But in each of these psalms, the righteous, or are they the wise, are able to look beyond their circumstances, all the attack that they're under, God's absence. They're able to look beyond that through the lens of faith in God's faithfulness. Yes, God may be absent, God may be at a distance, but a covenant-keeping God is bound to come to his people's aid. That is why in each of these psalms, in the middle of the enemy's onslaught, the righteous can confidently appeal to the Lord's covenant faithfulness as the reason that he should come and rescue his people. So, for example, Psalm 11. The psalmist expects to be delivered because the Lord is righteous. He's a covenant-keeping God. Psalm 13. The psalmist there says that it's the Lord's chesed, his unfailing covenant love, that ensures the salvation for the psalmist. In other words, God does right. God keeps his covenant. And that's what gives the psalmist confidence that God will not always be absent. I recite this background because it really gives us a good counterpoint to what's going on in Psalm 14:1. The words of the fool need to be set in opposition to the words of the righteous. The righteous face the problem of God's absence, but they still affirm that he will keep covenant. He will come, he will be present, and he will rescue his people. Now, Psalm 14, verse 1, gives us a kind of a covenantal via negativa. It is the covenant theology, as it were, of the wicked. They foolishly deny what the righteous affirm. The wicked say, God does not keep covenant. He will not come. He will remain absent, and he will not rescue his people. We've got free rein to attack them precisely because God is at a distance. We've already heard the wicked theologize. They say things like in Psalm 10, God has forgotten. He covers his face and never sees. Later in that same psalm, he will not call me to account. They have already implicitly denied the covenant faithfulness of God. He is not with his people. He is off at a distance or covering his eyes, unable, or more likely, unwilling to protect his people. And now in Psalm 14, the wicked speak again, and they say, there is no God. Now, I think the point there, because the context is more covenantal than it is philosophical, for me, there is no God in that context means something close to God doesn't keep covenant. God is absent. So when they say literally, or over-literally, God is not, they're saying something close to God is not here. He will not save the righteous, and he will not punish their oppressors. So we can act with impunity. This is, of course, the essence of foolishness, living as if God does not keep his word. It is foolishness, but the English word foolishness really isn't strong enough, though, to get at what the writer is trying to get at here. Fools are merely unwise, silly buffoons. But here, the foolishness is a morally culpable foolishness. It is a foolishness that is vile and corrupt. Well, that's verse 1. Oh, heck. Okay, that's introducing the psalm. Verse 2 starts to tell us the story. God, the Lord looks out from heaven on the sons of men. It'd take too long for me to justify this one, but I'm inclined to think that the Lord is taking a close, hard look at Israel rather than all humans. But that's not crucial to my interpretation, but I think it makes best sense of the psalm's covenantal context. Here's where things get complicated. The strong impression left by verse 3 is that the Lord only finds covenant breakers. All have turned aside. And there's none good, none that does good, not even one. All of Israel, or if you want, all of humanity, are covenant breakers, evildoers, as the psalmist calls them in verses 4 and 6. Pretty straightforward, isn't it? But there's one glitch. This group is set in opposition. In fact, they oppress a second group. And in verse 4, the Lord calls that second group my people, those who are being devoured by the evildoers. And in verse 5, he puts it more sharply. This oppressed group are the righteous. And by implication, they are the ones who seek God. So how could he look out? Well, you can see the question that's forming here. Righteousness in the Psalter is always a problem for us Protestants, because we equate righteousness with sinlessness, some form of perfect keeping of the Mosaic law. But such is not the case in the Old Testament. The righteous are those who trust in the Lord's covenant faithfulness, who live lives of loyal submission to the Lord, and who, when they sin, they repent, a la Psalm 51, and avail themselves of the sacrificial system to deal with their uncleanness. They may sin, but they are not numbered among the evildoers or the wicked. They are still righteous. In fact, in the very next psalm, we get a clear picture of the righteous. Their walk is blameless. They do what is righteous. In other words, they're not sinless, but they still keep covenant, Psalm 15:2. This means that when the Lord looks out from heaven, he actually sees two classes of people, the wicked and the righteous. And that's exactly the point that's made in Psalm 11, verses 4 and 5, just in the surrounding context. The Lord is on his heavenly throne. He observes the sons of men. His eyes examine them. The Lord examines the righteous, but the wicked and those who love violence, his soul hates, two groups. Now, here's what I think is going on in Psalm 14. The Lord looks out on Israel, or all humanity if you want to go in that direction, and sees the nation as a whole. The righteous have been reduced to an insignificant remnant, insignificant when it comes to defining the spiritual condition of the nation. The Lord is looking at Israel as a collective, not just a group of individuals, but the nation as an entity. And he concludes, all have turned aside, or perhaps a little more accurately, the whole, hakol, the whole has turned aside, and together, as one, they have become corrupt. So it's an overall picture of the whole nation. This is, or is like, the condition of Israel just before the exile. To be sure, there was still a remnant of righteous, prophets like Jeremiah, men like Daniel, but the nation as a whole had turned aside, had become corrupt. In fact, the language of Psalm 14 exactly echoes Moses' prediction made at the end of Deuteronomy. I know that that after my death you are sure to become utterly corrupt and to turn aside from the way that I've commanded you, Deuteronomy 31:29. In other words, what's going on here is the kind of situation that Moses saw as preceding the exile. So not surprisingly, Psalm 14 and verses 5 and 6, two very difficult verses, seem to speak of God's judgment on the wicked. Moses' prophecy about Israel's future apostasy included the prediction of God's judgment on the nation. In days to come, disaster will fall upon you because of the evil you've done, and so forth. And then after that, you get these very specific curses, covenant curses, that will fall on Israel. One of these curses is, if people will say, if it were only morning, because of the terror that will fill your heart. See, terror, dread, fear is a covenant curse. And this is echoed in the judgment of the wicked described in verse 5. There they are, overwhelmed with dread. The Deuteronomic background to Psalm 14 and the psalm's surprising ending in verse 7 incline me to think that verses 5 and 6 should be read in connection with Israel's Babylonian exile. The nation as a whole has turned to the Lord, so they, wicked and righteous alike, are sent into exile. So here's how I'd handle those two verses. There, I think, might be Babylon. There in exile, the wicked experience great dread. But, and I translate the key clause there as adversative, but God is still present with the righteous. The nation is in exile. The wicked fools have actually spoken prophetically. There is no God, and that's what they experience. They experience exile and God's absence. And of course, in exile and when God is absent, there's dread. That's all you get. Even in exile, however, God is still present with the righteous. So there's a difference. God is still present with the company of the righteous. Even while they are joined with the wicked under covenant curse, the Lord is still their shelter. And now I think the final verse starts to make more sense. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion when the Lord restores the fortunes of his people. Better translation, much better translation there is. Oh, so forth. when the Lord restores the captivity of his people. This is classic Deuteronomic return from exile language. And when that happens, let Israel rejoice and Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. These are the words of the righteous in exile. They are the people who have never stopped believing that God is with them, never stopped trusting in his covenant fidelity. And this is what gives him confidence that the Lord will bring salvation to his people. In other words, restoration back to the land. Okay, I stop there. Psalm 53, though, I move on to that. Well, okay, that's Psalm 14. At this point, I want to drop into some kind of, I could drop into application mode, but I don't do that and I haven't got time. So I'll have to leave you to do that. I think you can see some applications, but I want to move on, albeit briefly, and ask, what would Ray Dillard have done at this point? Well, here's what I think Ray might have done if he'd studied either Psalm 14 or 53. I think he would have paid attention to the differences between the two texts and asked, how do those differences help us understand the subtle nuances of each text's theology? Especially when a later text seems to have changed an earlier text. Now, Ray was at a great advantage studying Chronicles because Chronicles obviously comes after Kings, and it was easier for him to analyze Chronicles' changing of the book of Kings. The problem, of course, with Psalms 14 and 53 is you don't know which one comes first, although I suspect that Psalm 53 is an expansion of Psalm 14. So I'm going to kind of work with that assumption, although I might be wrong. But I'm going to try and do a Dillard. I'm going to assume that Psalm 53 is later than Psalm 14, and I'm going to try and tease out some of the theological significance of the slight differences between the two texts. As I said, the only significant, or maybe it's insignificant, difference between the two psalms is at verses 5 and 6. Verse 14, Psalm 14 again reads, "There they are, or better, there they were, overwhelmed with dread, for God is present in the company of the righteous. You evildoers frustrate the plans of the poor, but the Lord is their refuge." That now becomes, "There they were, overwhelmed with dread." The Hebrew is identical in both. The NIV changes it for some reason. "Where there was nothing to dread, God scattered the bones of those who attacked you, and you put them to shame, for God despised them." Okay, now watch me make an exegetical mountain out of this molehill. In other words, my reading of Psalm 53 is going to have a strong reader response element to it. I note with the two substantive changes. Psalm 53, one is that the oppressed are no longer called the righteous. Now, I doubt whether there's too much significance in this. It's not that the oppressed are no longer righteous, but it seems to now they're being more defined more as victims. Not only do the wicked devour this group, but they now attack them as well. Another way of getting at this is to say that in Psalm 53, the wicked are just a little more wicked than they were in Psalm 14. And God's response to their wickedness is also stronger. Now the punishment, exile, if this verse is describing it, is stronger. The focus is less on God's presence with the righteous. That's not the focus so much here, but rather on the punishment of the wicked. The metaphor of judgment is now no longer just merely dread. It is the more violent, destructive image of God scattering the bones of the wicked. It's a metaphor of utter destruction. Of course, that implies that something that has been made explicit at the end of this new verse, God, that will be made explicit at the end of this verse, God despises the wicked. It's just stronger. It seems like the emotional intensity of Psalm 53 is a notch or two higher than Psalm 14. The oppressed are more oppressed, the wicked are more wicked, and God is more ticked off, and his judgment is more severe. Perhaps I'm reading more into this than there, but Ray's careful work on Chronicles taught me to pay careful attention to even the slightest change in detail, and if I learned anything from him, it was to read the Bible carefully. But of course, you shouldn't blame him for my at times creative reading a biblical text. Let me just jump over stuff here. I'll talk a fair bit more here about the Psalm 51 and its context, and I'll leave that off to the side because of time. But it seems to me that the difference between these two texts is not significant, but I wonder if the second version of the psalm presents a slightly darker picture of Israel, or is it humanity's sinfulness, and a darker picture of God's response. Is there just a sense for the writer or editor of this psalm that things are even worse than the writer of Psalm 14 thought? Now, unfortunately, we can only speculate on the conditions that generated this apparently more negative analysis of the wicked. Now, quickly, Romans 3. Final exegetical move. This is the point I'm going to extend the Dillard trajectory. We come to Romans 3, 9 to 12, and Paul's citation of the psalm. You know the passage well. We have already made the charge that Gentiles and Jews and Gentiles alike are under sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have become together become worthless. There is none who does good, no, not even one. In order to understand Paul's use of this psalm, we have to know what he means by being under sin. He's clearly saying something more than, well, people sin. No, it's a stronger statement. He's saying something like, as John Murray says it, that people are under the dominion. They're enslaved, they're under the dominion of sin. They're enslaved to sin. And to prove this point, Paul gives a virtual word-for-word quotation of the Septuagint, the Greek, of Psalm 14:3. All have turned away, and you've already read the quote. I think actually that Paul is probably almost certainly quoting from Psalm 14 rather than 53. And then slightly more indirectly in verse 11, there is no one who understands, no one who seeks God, echoes Psalm 14:2 about the Lord looking down and looking for those who understand or seek God. Okay, I'm going to be honest. I'm surprised at Paul's use of Psalm 14 as evidence that all are under sin. And the more specific point that he makes at the beginning of this section, that there are none righteous. Why? Because Psalm 14, read grammatically, historically, doesn't make that point. There are righteous. Psalm 14 admits that most people are not righteous and under the dominion of sin, the wicked. But also it sets that group in opposition to another group who are righteous. In other words, the psalm Paul quotes does not support his argument. In fact, by opening his selection of Old Testament texts with the statement, there is no one righteous, Paul contradicts the grammatical historical meaning of Psalm 14. So what's Paul doing? Well, apparently not grammatical historical exegesis. In fact, Paul is making a significant break with classic Old Testament and Jewish theology. The basic contours of that theology are, that people sin. But just because you sin doesn't necessarily put you in the category of sinner. You can sin and still be righteous if you follow the Lord and keep Torah in the sense that I described earlier. What we have here is that what's happened is that in the light of the death and resurrection of Christ, Paul has reanalyzed the spiritual condition of both Israel and the Gentiles and concludes radically, even shockingly for a Jew, that all are under the power of sin. And even the righteous are now found to be unrighteous. Now, how he gets there is a long story. I'm not going to go into that in the 2 seconds I have left. At least up until his conclusion, conversion, Saul of Tarsus, I think, would have adopted a reading of Psalm 14 that's close to its grammatical historical sense. He would have categorized the Gentiles and the apostate Jews, like the early Christians, as among the wicked. In fact, this man who breathed out threats against the Christians might even have preferred Psalm 53 over Psalm 14 because of its strong theology of God despising the wicked and this glorious vision of their utter destruction. Saul of Tarsus, blameless before the law, would have read Psalm 14 and identified himself, of course, with the righteous. But his reflections on the death and resurrection of Jesus have somehow revealed to him that even righteous Torah-observing Jews like himself are under sin, now understood as a enslaving, oppressive power, and closely identified with Satan, the great enemy of God. And so the category of righteous, because of this new understanding of who is sinful, what is sin, the category of righteous in Psalm 14 has vanished into thin air. There really is only one category of human after all, the wicked. So all, including the righteous, are now seen to have turned aside. No one, not even the righteous, does good. There is no one righteous, not even the righteous. And now Paul interprets his previous life of zeal for the Lord and his law as nothing more than practical atheism. He had known the story of Jesus, but previously he had concluded, oh, there is no God. God is not here in the story of this man. But that would be foolishness now to Paul as he reanalyzes the way things are. In Paul's new reading of Psalm 14, it is as if he's gone back to the original author and said, listen, the guy who revised your psalm to give us Psalm 53 was on the right track. The wicked are more wicked than you originally depicted them. But if both of you didn't go far enough, the righteous aren't as righteous as you thought. They too are evildoers. But Paul can only say that because he now understands the identity of the real enemy in a way that goes way beyond Psalm 14. Jesus has exposed the enemy behind the enemies. It is neither apostate Jews nor Gentiles like the Romans. All are under sin's thrall, bondage. And so the ultimate oppressive evildoer is that monster, sin, who enslaves both wicked and righteous alike. So Paul's reading, I am almost done, of Psalm 14 is remarkably dark and pessimistic, but I venture to suggest that he could turn it in a more optimistic, gospel-centered direction. Remember how the psalm ends with a judgment of the wicked and hope for deliverance? My bet is that Paul would say something like this. See, once you understand that the real enemy is sin, or Satan, or death for that matter, the good news is that God has condemned sin, Romans 8:3. And then to use the language of Psalm 53, in God, in Christ, God has despised the real enemy, sin. God has scattered his bones. Sin has been defeated. The company of the righteous who vanished under sin's dominion are now reconstituted in Christ and now may rejoice and be glad because God has come out of Zion to deliver them from exile. Such a Christotelic reading. Rereading allows us to redeem the basic message of the psalm, which is the affirmation that God keeps his covenant promises to rescue his people. One last paragraph. Quite frankly, I don't know how Radial would have handled these texts. He might have thrown up his hands in horror at this point. Maybe he would have looked at it very differently from what I've done. But I know that he would have ended this at the same point that I've ended, more or less. And he would have tried to have pointed you to Jesus Christ. That's where I've tried to go with this. He would have pointed to Christ as the climactic manifestation of God's covenant. That's what drove Ray in all his thinking. That's where it always ended. If that's his legacy, may we all seek to preserve it. You are dismissed.